and so to our illustrious guest tonight. In a writing career of over 45 years, Tom Kenneally has published 37 novels, 15 works of non-fiction, and 4 plays. It's a prodigious output that has been rightly acclaimed both locally and internationally. He won the Booker for Schindler's Ark in 1982, and he was shortlisted with 3 more novels. He won the Miles Franklin twice and was shortlisted another twice, and I think he's won almost every other state literary award in this country. But from the outset, Tom Kenneally's theme has been identity, how we understand and how we make sense of ourselves. Both his fiction and his non-fiction have tackled the issue. But he isn't, in fact, a parochial writer. He's as likely to write about the Bolsheviks in 1917 as persecuted Jews in 1945, or starving Irish poor in the 19th century, or, in fact, Eritrea in the 1970s. The world is his canvas. His abiding interest has been history. Not the great men and their exploits, but history, not history as a saga or as an epic, but rather the ordinary people, the small people, the marginal characters, the men and women whose stories will never feature in the history books or the grand narratives. He's been critically acclaimed as one of our great historical novelists, great practitioner of the art. And of course, we all know here tonight that there's been a lot of debate about the relationship between history and fiction as forms of writing and what each genre owes to the past. For a writer like Kenneally, who works across both fiction and non-fiction, the distinctions are important. He says, in non-fiction, you try to tell the truth by telling the truth. In the novel, you feel the freedom to tell the truth by creating divine lies. You can mess around with the characters. The aim of the novelist, he says, is verisimilitude. However, the novelist, in good historical fiction, is also always trying to talk about the present. And so Kenneally has repeatedly returned to the problem of our past and its effect on our sense of ourselves. The theme was already there in the chant of Jimmy Blacksmith in 1972, a devastating critique of the treatment of Indigenous Australians. Recently, though, he described that novel as a reckless intervention into the sad history of white-black relations in Australia. He has returned to those tragic events, but with increasing hesitation in recent years, overcome by sensitivity and indeed caution for speaking on behalf of Indigenous Australians. He's described the Aboriginal issue as Australia's Ulster, the snake in the Australian garden. And I think that despite the redemptive quality of the former Prime Minister's apology, I suspect that Tom Kenneally feels we have much left to repair on this issue. Tom Kenneally's been published by every good publisher in this country. I was personally fortunate to work with him in the early 1990s. In 1993, we published his novel Jacko, a hugely entertaining novel and a manifesto entitled Our Republic. As one of the ARM's best loved spokesperson, Tom argued valiantly that the Queen of England might be a worthy head of state for Britain, but was neither relevant to nor meaningful any longer in a modern multicultural Australia. So persuading Tom to come to Heinemann was a source of great pride for us all. He was already a national living treasure, if I remember, but he was also one of Australia's very few hugely successful literary exports. So we were proud to publish such a distinguished writer. But it's true to say that Kenneally, with his extraordinary ability to deliver a novel or two every year, was equally attractive to us as publishers. There was also the sheer pleasure of working with a writer as alive to his times, an engaged writer, a writer who wrote as generously as he thought about the world around him and his fellow citizens. And then there was this remarkable lack of pretension about Tom. He didn't think of himself as an artist, but rather as a journeyman writer, for whom writing was, as he liked to say, an industrial proposition. Now, Tom's usually viewed as a jolly, gregarious, warm and indeed friendly character. He's got a sharp wit, but it's always accompanied by a twinkling eye, so few of us actually get to see the steel in his spine. I was fortunate, perhaps, to catch a glimpse of that steel during the editing process of Jacko. Publishers with an editorial bent like myself, we like to sit with our authors and offer advice and proffer opinions. Authors enjoy those encounters, slightly less. They feign interest and very occasionally, take our advice. With Tom, who always appears to be listening attentively, I plunged in. Tactfully, I thought, but very enthusiastically, because I adore the novel, but I thought there were things we could discuss. It only dawned on me later that Tom had worked through this novel. He was indeed happy to discuss it at length, but was going to do precisely what he wanted with his own novel. And I never really understood his resistance until I came across a response that he made in another interview. Sometimes, he said, if you get rid of something wrong, you end up with a nicely ruled margin, an A-plus technical novel. But the fury has gone, the intensity is gone. So it's almost impossible to write a novel that doesn't have some original sin in it, some essential imperfection. And of course, Tom is right. It's the intensity and fury that matter in storytelling, not technical wizardry or mastery. So Tom's generous and open-hearted literary style, the apparent ease with which he writes, the seemingly endless supply of first-rate stories engenders, or occasionally engenders, disdain rather than enthusiasm among Australian critics. It's a condition that some of us call small pondism, end-of-the-worldism, backwateritis. Tom Keneally's legion of fans are delighted that his passion for good storytelling has not been dampened by the occasional petty review. And that small pondism that besets the local literary community on occasion is merely a symptom of a more general condition, which brings us back to the theme for tonight's address, the problem of identity. In an interview some years ago, Tom described an early tussle with this problem from his school years at St Pat's in Strathfield. And I hope you'll forgive me if I can't channel Tom. He'll channel himself later. He said, "I know all writers have memories of being on the outer because the children on the side of the playground become the dangerous writers. And the children in the centre of the playground actually go on and do constructive things with their lives. I enjoyed school, but I had great problems with the ink. And I also had great problems with wheezing and with discharge, which I couldn't deal with. A constantly runny nose, there is nothing that can evoke the contempt of a smart 5-year-old girl who turns in perfect homework, like the contempt that she shows for a mucus leaker. Oh, sister, look what's happening to this page. That's that sort of thing. But I did feel on the outer," Tom says. "But then every writer says that. I remember Mother Beningus drawing a chalk mark around the urinals and telling us that any boy who piddled above that line would be inviting the wrath of God and the shame of the Virgin Mary." And so even though at that point Australia stood a good chance of falling to the Japanese, which would have indeed been a cosmic event, we were fixated on this whole thing about not peeing too high, not having peeing contests. And God, well, you know the thunder of God. And so Australians of my background, he finishes, lived in a doubly cosmic universe. So from those primary school years in the 1940s to the present, Tom has been painfully aware of a contradiction in Australia's psyche. As he says, we alternate between a view of ourselves as equals on the world stage and the fear that we're in danger because boatloads of strangers are coming our way and we must be protected. We'll never be a good community while we don't have faith in our own robustness, he says, so that we can take a few strangers in and to hell with their strangeness. It's that generosity of spirit and intellect, that open-mindedness and plain speaking, that are the hallmarks of one of Australia's most distinguished writers and citizens. Please join me in welcoming Tom Keneally to the microphone.
Well, it's the old Harpo Marx problem. Would you trust a festival of ideas at which you were asked to present your own ideas? It seemed a good thing when Patrick, a good and flattering thing to accept when Patrick asked me. But I will do my best tonight, and I should say hello to the people in Shepparton because I love the northeast up there. The nice bits of it that aren't Kelly country. It's a truism that the people most certain about national identity are often the ones who draw the boundaries most narrowly and who are moved to deplore whatever they see as lying outside the boundaries. To take one example, the former Minister of Immigration, Kevin Andrews, was certain about national identity in 2007 when he criticised the Sudanese community. He was, in fact, more certain in a few sentences than I will probably manage to be in 45 minutes of palaver tonight. But I'm attracted to the Andrews statement because I have travelled in the Sudan during the years of oppression and chaotic civil war, which have not ended, actually, even though there was a peace agreement in 2005. I must make it clear before we begin that in mentioning and going on to analyse what Kevin Andrews said or anyone else said, I'm not intending to label them with easily accessible and catch-all pejorative words. For here we have to talk primarily about what we believe as a community and not what we should believe about what we do and not what we should do. to try seriously to define identity isn't primarily an exercise in morality or social improvement. Things might be said, however, in the pursuit of the question that are enlightening, and I hope that that works tonight, even though this audience is scary because it's full of people who have thought long and rigorously on the matter. In any case, back to the Sudanese immigrants. Mr. Andrews said, some groups don't seem to be settling and adjusting into the Australian way of life as quickly as we would hope. This is a cry that's been heard throughout Australian history, no more so than in the past two decades. He accused the refugees of refusing to embrace the Australian way because of their race-based gangs, altercations between various groups from Africa, and tensions within families. It's true he didn't back his claims with any figures, but there is some of this, undeniably, in the community, some of this occurring, the elements he complained of, within that community. I've now begun the speech by moving from page one to page three. Excuse me a moment. He didn't mention any important aspects of advances in adaptation to Australia amongst Sudanese immigrants, adaptations, because they lay outside his certainties of identity. And in part two, he was not telling the Australian public what the Department of Immigration was actually doing with the Sudanese. He was hiding his department's light under a bushel. He wasn't telling the Australian people that the Department of Immigration was rescuing some Sudanese from camps like Kakuma in Kenya, of which his own department's Sudanese community profile of 2007 reported, there is frequent violence in the camp, regular clashes occur among residents, many of them armed, sexual assault is common, children may have been born in the camps and are unfamiliar with any other lifestyle. Nor did he mention that given this unspeakable background, the Sudanese Association of Australia and similar bodies do what they can to bridge the gulf of experience between civil war and what can justly be called ethnic cleansing by the Sudanese central government on the one hand and a settled Australian life on the other. The Sudanese Association's aims include to do all lawful things in the best interests of the community. In 2007, it signed a memorandum of agreement with the Victoria Police with the obvious aim of guiding Sudanese youth through the criminal system, but also of helping with law and order issues. It is not as if, as a community, they aren't trying. There has been no lack of commentators who have in the past two decades uttered very nearly the same sentences as Mr. Andrews about one Australian immigrant group or another, particularly groups from countries such as Vietnam and Lebanon, where nations where law and order has broken down catastrophically, as it has in the Sudan, for long and savage periods. It's true that the phases of adjustment of new arrivals to Australia have never been without some bemusement from both established Australians and the new arrivals, both. These adjustments often take place far from the fashionable suburbs and do undeniably put nearly as much pressure on the longer settled locals as on the new arrivals. They impose a temporary cultural bewilderment in those who consider themselves the true Australians and call forth from them what has been, till now, in Australian history, a blessedly temporary hostility. But the locals, apart from suspicion, also frequently offer, individually and through organizations, fraternal support as well. And the people who draw identity narrowly often depict the immigrant group as making no attempt itself to find their place in society. All is decency and Australianness on this side of the narrowly drawn fence, and all is ill will on the other. I argue that though this mutual coming to terms, is not a departure from the Australian way of life. It is and has been the Australian way of life for most of my existence. If one lives long enough, one sees that what we first deplore, we end by celebrating, and what we don't want a bar of becomes that of which we boast on Australia Day. Let me tell you about some immigrants I encountered as a child. I have no intention of cultural belittlement in telling you this story. It is the literal truth. It was an era in which Greeks and Italians were often referred to charmingly, according to a quote in The Age, as the Abos of Southern Europe. A family from a particular region of Southern Europe, a region hard-soiled and harrowed with poverty, moved in next door to us in the charming suburb of Homebush, New South Wales, a place which I've often called the epicentre of Australian ennui. We were somewhat astonished to find that, as they reasonably enough had done on the hard earth they came from, they used their night soil as fertilizer in the garden. Being generous, they offered my mother some of the crop of their tomatoes, which were rich and plump. So how's that for cultural bewilderment? My mother was a progressive woman and accepted the gift with thanks. I cannot remember if we ate them or not. I know as well, though, that both the daughters of that family went to university. Extraordinary transition. Indeed, cultural accommodations on both sides have been vastly helped in my lifetime by equality of opportunity, another plank of Australian identity. And we still like to believe that that equality exists. Many assert it does. One hopes it does, though the figures themselves are not necessarily entirely hopeful. And as we all know, equality of opportunity has been a hard struggle for the Aboriginal community, is still being painfully worked out, with the balance of pain very unequal indeed. But to return to the assertion, I argue it's part of Australian identity to adjust and come to treasure the stranger, whereas many commentators consider distrust a valid statement of the same identity. While politicians and civic leaders, after all, often congratulate us on tolerance, I met a charming academic this afternoon who very pleasantly challenged my use of the word tolerance. I hope you'll, because it has that pejorative side of, I'll put up with you. I'll make an attempt at toleration. I don't try to use it in that sense of toleration. Politicians and civic leaders congratulate us on tolerance. At the same time, there is in all of us something that likes to see Australia as a hermetically sealed entity, which even a few hundred hapless creatures on a leaky boat can puncture and violate. Another childhood story arises, it always does when you're 75, as I am, from the unforgettable first 6 months of 1942, very formative months for my view of the world. I've never forgotten two particular Norman Lindsay's covers for the Bulletin. One was of a rock-jawed digger with rifle ready to parry the advance of Japanese military down the archipelagos of Southeast Asia and looking quite up to doing the job. And the other was of Australia as a threatened maiden. She was very well endowed, as you'd expect of Norman Lindsay, and she is facing a leering Japanese soldier. I believe that it is contradictorily part of Australian identity to show a robust face of the world when it accords with our perception of events, and to be the threatened maiden when it does not. I believe we became very much the threatened maiden during the Tampa incident, when our imaginations were routed by the idea that we might be invaded by 438 powerless and disoriented Afghans, whose un-Australian behaviour was emphasised for our benefit by the then Prime Minister, and whose invasion might be followed by hordes more like them. So we are viscerally attracted to what we see as our stable identity, our enclosed garden of Australian values. Indeed, there's a reason for this historically, I think, in that we were promised a rose garden. We were promised an Australian garden at the time of Federation. It was to be a Caucasian garden, partially based on misreadings of Darwinism, on the science of phrenology, on the superiority of Bible-based Christianity to other creeds, and a conscientiously held belief that intermarriage between Europeans and Asians was miscegenation and was destructive of culture. It was also based on the shared value of keeping coolie labour out of Australia. The unity of Australia is nothing, said the remarkable Alfred Deakin of this city, if it does not imply a united race. A united race means not only that its members can intermix, intermarry, and associate without degradation on either side, but implies one inspired by the same ideas and an aspiration towards the same ideals, a people qualified to live under the Constitution. Deakin, as the first federal attorney general, was the first speaker in the Immigration Restriction Bill of 1901, whose purpose, you know, was to get Asians out of Australia and the South Seas Islanders, commonly known as the Kanakas. He said in his debate that he had respect for Asia. It was purely a matter of protecting the equity of white Australians in their own country, though, that white Australia was to emerge. He confessed an intellectual interest in Buddhism and Hinduism, which was not insincere, because he pursued studies into both religions while he was in India looking into irrigation, hoping to apply the methods along the Murray. But he wanted to avoid, for Australians, the poverty he'd seen in India. Whiteness was therefore an essential part of the Australian utopia, and in its name, all the others were cleared out. Deakin's ideal Australia was also protectionist, not globalised. His Australia would be one in which protection created adequate wealth to justify fair wages. The harbingers of the utopia were tariffs, the frugal comfort of the basic wage arising from the harvester case, the pension, the franchise for women, and other progressive reforms. So in our federal garden, the flora and fauna were, and we sometimes still wish they were, familiar. The pathways are orderly. We have certainty as to where they will lead. People queue according to enlightened traditions inherited from Northern Europe for water and for food, and vacate seats on the benches in an orderly manner when their turn is up. But clamorous at the gate are people who, we believe, understand none of that, do not know the rules of the park, and we fear harbour an act of contempt for them. The fact that in the past many of those admitted from the great mass outside into this garden have not shown any contempt for the place does not count in our fear of the people outside the gate at this very moment. In my lifetime, I've seen identity, the value of the enclosed garden, called up to resist the entry of Italians and Greeks because of their un-Australian manners, Eastern Europeans because of their inscrutable language and their hunger for success, Chinese because they broke the ethnic tapestry of Australia, Serbs and Croats because they hated each other, Vietnamese because they made gangs, Muslims because they're not only members of gangs but jihadists as well, and besides they wear the hijab, and so on. At every turn, though, the garden has proven to be more capacious and adaptable than we thought it could be. The walls, which seem so solid and immutable, actually shift. It is as if they were built of paper, not of stone. But also at every turn, from the 19th century to the 21st, the rhetoric of exclusion has been persistent. It has always been interchangeable, in the sense that if a particular statement of concern about perceived ethnic threat were deprived of its dateline, we'd have a hard time saying exactly when it was uttered. By that I mean, recently I wrote a little book which compared three major famines, Ethiopia, Bengal and Ireland, spread out over a century and a half. And unless you knew that a particular thing was said in Ethiopia in the 1980s, you'd think they were talking about either of the two other famines. And it's a bit like that with ethnic fear in this country. We don't quite know where the date is unless we're told. The date of what was said. We are familiar with Pauline Hanson's condemnation of Asians. They have their own culture and religion, form ghettos and do not assimilate. But in her maiden speech, she also quoted a famous Australian as saying, "Do we want or need any of these people here? I am one red-blooded Australian who says no, and who speaks for 90% of Australians." Well, that was Artie Caldwell, Labor Party leader, some 45 to 50 years before Pauline. And who is being talked about in the following case? The settlers of North Queensland are generally of an undesirable type and do not make good settlers. Consideration should be given immediately to the racial stock of the immigrant. The missing word in that sentence is Greek, the Greek settlers of North Queensland, of an undesirable type. And this is the work of Thomas Ferry, Commissioner of the 1925 Queensland Royal Commission into Aliens in North Queensland. I've got to give him his credit. He did like the Italian cane cutters. Endless instances of such rhetoric can be found throughout Australian history. There's no doubt that even now, in this century, in our struggles with the rawness and newness of events, we often cling to the Federation Garden as if it did contain all our identity hermetically sealed. But if one looks at the general results of immigration and the sometimes total, the sometimes only partial triumph of necessity and goodwill over fear, an aphorism of Robert Hughes comes to mind. Hughes wrote, "A culture raised on immigration cannot escape feelings of alienness and must transcend them in two different ways: by concentration on identity, origins, and the past, or by faith in newness, N-E-W-N-E-S-S, as a value in itself." In the latter spirit, such programs as the Good Neighbour schemes of the 1940s and the contemporary Rural Australians for Refugees show a faith in newness as a value. And to underscore the point, they show that faith in the new is part of Australian identity too. No one is saying that Australian tolerance is a perfect virtue, but as a social force, I think it has had notable successes. Contrary to the idea of total triumph, of course, one has to mention the Cronulla riots, the recorded cries on both sides, "These skippies want war, go home, Lebs," etc., the salivation and thunderbolts of shock jocks, the hopes of tabloids that would go on as the French race, very differently race-based riots went on in 2005 and 6, that it would go on for months. After Cronulla, there were some days of unrest and mutual insults, and even a display of firearms outside the Lakemba Mosque, fortunately not fired, partly because the imam pleaded for peace. Apart from the police lockdown of the beach community, leaders from both sides, including such core Australian bodies as Life Saving Australia, worked to settle the matter peaceably. In fact, on the Thursday after Cronulla, three buffy Aussie surf lifesavers of the Surf Life Saving Club, of which I was a social member, non-rowing, non-lifesaving, at Bilgola Beach, three solid Australian Adonises rescued five Afghans from the Newport Express. That's the express that sweeps around the headland from Bilgola Beach to Newport and takes you with it and tries to send you under. Australian tolerance on the Snowy River scheme in the 1950s was described in the following terms by the journalist and novelist-to-be George Johnson. "The average man," he said, "is willing to accept the migrant if he brings with him no threat to the standard of living and a readiness to become a fair dinkum Aussie." Admittedly, the term fair dinkum Aussie begs the question. As one commentator said, the demand that newcomers become fair dinkum toot sweet dehumanized migrants. Its fundamental implication was that migrants were at best inferior and undesirable, and at worst positively dangerous and threatening. Well, there's certainly truth in that. But Johnson does seem to have summed up a proposition I've heard from many Australians, which has operated in the relationship between established Australians and newcomers throughout the major shocks of immigration to Australia since World War II. And the point is that many migrants claim that under that kind of tolerance and under broader gestures as well, they soon enough felt acceptance more than they felt condescension. I would say that a functional, in quotes, functional tolerance, a pragmatic, rough-handed, sometimes grudging tolerance, has produced in Australia, in world terms, fairly speedy acceptance of new groups. And it works, I'm talking comparatively, and if you look at the Republic of Sudan, we look pretty good. To deny that is to deny the assertion of many a happily settled immigrant. It is to deny the goodwill, for example, of one Dr. Stepan Kekyasharian, speaking in Yass last Australia Day, "As a migrant of Armenian heritage, I feel great pride to have been accepted into this nation, and I am not alone." So this functional tolerance is not perfect, but it does mean that though for a generation a notable concentration of an immigrant group might occur in certain suburbs, classic ghettos of the kind found in France and Germany don't exist. Functional tolerance is enshrined in anti-discrimination laws and anti-vilification laws, and there exists in Australia a remarkably, if I'm sounding too roseate about this, don't worry, I'll get on to the criticisms later. Remarkably easy progress to citizenship once residence is achieved, always admitting that achieving residence is the hard bit. This kind of acceptance, pragmatic, sometimes patronising, is often less hypocritical than the oratorical and underachieving tolerance of other societies. Schindler survivor, the late Edek Korn of Sydney, is simply one of the immigrants I've known to whom tolerance was one of the most important aspects of Australian identity, to the extent that he kept on saying, "Thank God we came to Australia." But it was sometimes a very backhanded acceptance. Something of a sage, Korn told me once, "Australians are funny people. When they don't know you and don't like you, they call you a wog bastard. Then they get to know you and like you and they call you a wog bastard." He told me too that his wife came home in a state of amazement from her first Australian job in a factory, saying, "They hate the Polish Catholics as much as they hate Polish Jews." To Leosha Korn, this was equality at last. And again, this is not to deny that many, and probably most newcomers, have had wounding and savage words flung at them on their way into the Australian garden, within which the level of urbanity fluctuates, particularly on commercial radio. An Australian-born woman of Malaysian Chinese background broke my heart as hers had been broken, by telling me that while shopping in the Hanson days of the later 1990s, she was shouted at and advised to go home. Australian born, advised to go home. It's a safe bet that a woman in a hijab has been abused somewhere today while taking her children to or from school. And yet, here's a blasphemous proposition. Racism is not entirely Australian, it is sadly global, whereas it could be argued that the style of acceptance in Australia is, both in its strengths and in its flaws, is particularly Australian, and Edek Korn spoke to that proposition. Not unrelated to our other beliefs and identity, it was always assumed by us that anti-authoritarianism was a potent part of our character, an index of our egalitarian tradition. And that has now been de-emphasized in historiography, however. Russell Ward, the author of The Australian Legend, has been attacked almost as much as, for varying reasons, Geoffrey Blainey and Manning Clark, for such arguments as that the Australian believes that Jack is not only as good as his master, but is probably a good deal better, and so he is a knocker of eminent people. He is fiercely an independent person who hates officiousness and authority. And despite all, there must be some truth there. For other visitors, from Anthony Trollope to James Michener, mentioned Australian manners of egalitarianism and mockery of authority. Mockery of the pompous is often seen as an inheritance of bushrangers and the two world wars. Australian stretcher bearer, whose journal I was reading the other day, wrote "Sensation in Cairo Today, an Australian saluted an officer." I was raised by my father on stories of how he borrowed officers' clothing to go into the officers' only bar at Shepherd's Hotel. And if there were officers from the best British regiments there who could be outraged, then you set out to do it. We'd like to think that in this century we retain some of that larrikinism and capacity for mockery. Reasonably, we're not so keen on anti-authoritarianism when it involves the invasion of suburban parties and attacks on police vehicles sent to impose authority. And we ought to remember that when the word larrikin was first applied to the Australian urban working class, it was meant to be an unflattering word. We are, in fact, more susceptible to authority, I fear, than the stories I just told would indicate. Even a child must be detained in an immigration centre if his parents or he seek asylum. It is true that Prime Minister Gillard's policy is not to put children behind heavy security razor wire for years, as happened in previous regimes. But even in February 2010, there were over 1,000 children under 18 years detained in various immigration detention centres, of whom nearly 400 were unaccompanied children. And the Prime Minister had not, at the time I wrote this, and I hope she has since, she has not ruled out the possibility that children and pregnant women will be sent to Malaysia under her new scheme. This should be authoritarian enough for anyone. Jump the queue at the ice cream stand, kid, and you'll get what's coming to you. The instances of authoritarianism towards Aboriginals, from sequestering of wages to child kidnapping, are of course numberless. And now authoritarianism is set to have a good century, beginning with the legislation passed in response to 9/11. But the aspect of identity, if I might close with this, the aspect of identity that fascinates, teases, and comforts me above all is the enduring utopian view of Australia that rose in the late 19th century. There are a number of utopian writers of the period who still resonate and whose vision of Australia is not unlike ours. Bernard O'Dowd's famous poem, which you no doubt know, first published in the Bulletin, beloved of progressive politicians, this poem famously raised the issue of whether Australia would be adrift Sargasso, where the West in halcyon calm rebuilds her fatal nest, that is, whether she would be a repeat of old world injustices, or would Australia be the Delos of a coming sun god's race. The culture of the surf, which took over Australia almost immediately after Federation, reinforced O'Dowd's sentiments about the sun god race. John Farrell, another Bulletin poet, wrote that he, God, wrought her perfect in a happy cline, the her being Australia, and held her worthiest and bade her wait serene on her lone couch inviolate the heightened manhood of a later time. So the heightened manhood was to be the Australian. In the late 1890s, before she went to Paraguay to try to recreate a new Australia, a Nueva Australia in the jungle, Dame Mary Gilmore, to be Mary Cameron, was a boarder at the Lawson household, and Henry, who rather wanted to marry her, would take her to see the slums. He used to take me to see the wrong things, the things repressive of the rights of Australia, the things like a blot upon her and which prevented her from being herself, the low-wage workers, the pale seamstresses, the neglected children of the quay and elsewhere, and so on. It's significant that young Mary saw Australia as of its destiny, a blessed place, and that it was only the things repressive of the rights of Australia, or the things which prevented her from being herself, that stood in the way of utopia. To some, federation represented the culmination and the basis for utopian Australia. The word Commonwealth had been proposed by Henry Parkes, and the commentators on the Constitution, Quick and Garran, he proposed it at the convention of 1891, as early as that, and Quick and Garran said that the word did more to arrest the public attention and kindle the public imagination than any other word in the English language could have done. It stands today for the type and the ideal of Australian nationhood. In the 1890s depression and the depression of the 1930s, the idea of the working man's paradise, the Commonwealth, proposed by Parkes, and the sun god's race joined the unemployment lines. The depression of both those eras was a great shock to Australian utopianism. Yet the idea that most sufferings and indignities were somehow un-Australian and that things that prevented Australia from being her true self, that idea remained very strong. I know this from the atmosphere in which I grew up, in a bush infancy and a suburban boyhood. And you get this sense of specialness of being member to a potential utopia. Well described in David Day's biography, when the Japanese landing craft lay off Malaya and the Japanese fleet were fueling its aircraft for an historic attack on Hawaii, the atheist and socialist Prime Minister John Curtin attended the rededication of a Presbyterian church near Canberra, rededication by a friend of his called the Reverend Harrison. On that afternoon, Curtin saw the faces of the Presbyterians who'd settled the plains of Canberra in the 19th century and felt stirring in him, despite the fact that they were probably all country voters, country party voters, felt stirring in him the concept that this was a race too precious to be obliterated by the tide of militarism. This powerful assumption that Australia was precious because it was a unique social experiment was a concept in which I was raised, as I said earlier, even though two of the underpinnings of the utopia, protection and white Australia, were long gone. Yet the utopian impulse is with us to this day. The present Prime Minister believes so strongly in the specialness of Australia as 19th century utopians did. To celebrate Australia Day, Miss Gillard concentrated on the natural catastrophes of last year. People say it's incredible, the generosity of strangers, but they weren't strangers, really. They were Australians. She quoted the historian Gavin Dawes, who wrote of Japanese prisoner of war camps that even while starving, the national groups of prisoners, quotes, retained inextinguishably American-Australian British trays. The Americans were the great individualists of the camps. The British clung to their class structure like bulldogs, and the Australians kept trying to construct little male bonded welfare states. Julia Gillard says that now we've moved beyond simple male bonding and welfare states, but the special ethos of solidarity amongst Australians remains. In this century, I was much taken by the statement of a Queensland householder who believed himself covered for the ruin of his house by flood water and found that his insurance policy failed through a technicality to protect him. He told an ABC interviewer, "I mean, this is Australia, isn't it?" He, like the rest of us, assumed till then that special arrangements of fairness and treatment along sensible, practical, fraternal lines are part of the Australian fabric and inheritance. Our continuing and incurable belief in millennial Eden in Commonwealth and uncommon institutions remains. When we reach for the fair go, however, are we reaching for a chimera? Professor Belinda Probert writes, "Looking back from 1901, it's hard to know which is more remarkable, the stability of the class compromise achieved at Federation or the speed with which it has unravelled over the past 20 years. So the fair go still exists if you compare the welfare figures welfare paid to Australian families by comparison with the US, but I don't think that should be a great comfort, because US welfare is only 20% of medium household income. In Australia, it's nearly 50%. In neither case is it an arrangement I would like to live under, but at least the fair go still seems to be there in that arrangement. But at closer look, the figures are skewed by other factors. The Brotherhood of St. Lawrence released an oft-quoted and frightening report on Australian equality in 2005-06. Based on the figures of the Bureau of Statistics, it found that the wealthiest 20% of families owned 61% of household wealth, and the poorest 20% owned 1%. 4.5 million Australian people lived in households whose gross income was less than $400 a week. Now, as in Lawson's day, we can assert that they lie, the men who tell us, for reasons of their own, that want is here a stranger and that misery is unknown. It is true that the other liberal democracies have been suffering similar degeneration of the terms of equality under the impact of, the GFC, globalisation. The unrepentant and unrenounced economic fundamentalism which brought us the great global financial crisis, and which is still confident of its power and its rightness. But will we be able to boast of equality in Australia on Australia Days in the future, when we look for some reasonably true rhetoric to present to our fellow citizens? One of the best remaining chances for Australian equity is the very expectations we have as citizens of decent minimum levels of public health, public education, and public communications. These issues represent a divide in American politics, but here in Australia, they represent a consensus. Both Bob Katter and the Labor left opposed the Telstra sell-off for fear communications would suffer. Details a matter of political argument, but the basic propositions about state responsibility are not. Abstracting for a moment from a debate on the Bill of Rights, it's along the same lines, I think, that a good level, taking away, from the sedition legislation passed unwisely in relation to 9/11. Leaving that aside, a level of free speech by comparison with the Republic of China, it exists largely because people think it exists, and people still think that Australian equity exists, and that helps it exist. And so perhaps might utopianism in Australia defy world forces in this century, at least for a time. The fear that it will be squeezed from our marrow by the force of new realities is one we're uneasy to face, for without it we'll definitely become, in spirit and culture, not that special society, but not that sun god's race, but someone's merely unequal and dreary province. Our glittering array of resources give us a chance for equity and also a chance to deal people out of the equation if we choose to. Thank God a resources tax is at least canvassed. Otherwise, we could ultimately be headed in the direction of Brazil with only Deakin's fig leaf to protect us from the blaze of a brutal world. Thank you.
Well, our lecturer is probably exhausted, but he has kindly agreed to take some questions. I think we have roving mics in both aisles, so if you would like to put up your hands, we've got, well, we haven't got much time, but I think the festival director will allow us a few questions. So there's microphones here if people would like to ask questions. And I think we have we got the lapel mics on, so you can stay seated if you'd like, Tom. So there's questions. There's one there.
Hi. Given that previously you've spoken about Aboriginals not, or you being unable as a white Australian to represent them authentically, perhaps, what ways do you think a space can be opened for them to be able to have their own voice in an effective manner?
Since I wrote the Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, which, as I said, no Caucasian writer or any other race other than Aboriginals should attempt to write now from within an Aboriginal's point of view. It'd just be bad manners. There's been the emergence of a huge number of Australian writers, Australian Aboriginal writers, I mean. Alexis Wright is a recent example, a brilliant book. Understanding of the Aboriginal cosmology from within that cosmology. And I think you are seeing a lot of Aboriginal voices emerge, even in the decade after the Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith was written. You had the emergence of playwrights like Jack Davis and artists of all stripe. I don't think there's a lack of Aboriginal voices now. That's why I think that it would be improper for me to do now what I attempted to do then.
Any other questions? This is another one here.
Hi, thanks for your speech. I'd like to ask about, you said that the riots in France in 2005 were race-based. I'd like to kind of question that and whether or not like there might be some well, first of all, religious grounds and another so relating to recognition of culture or religion or economic kind of motivations or inspirations for those kind of events, and the same here in Australia.
Yes, you're saying that there are economic issues and other issues as well as. Yes, I tried not to use the word racism because it's become such an easy portmanteau. And I think there is economics in there. White Australia was argued on economic grounds. It was popular with the unions. They felt that the indentured labourers from the South Seas had taken jobs away from them in Queensland. And so there are these economic considerations as well, and all manner of other fears that perhaps don't fit under that portmanteau term. And so I think I slipped into using that term once, and I shouldn't have, because I don't think it's a rigorous enough term anymore. Who am I to judge the motives and the behaviour of other people? I tried to look at Kevin Andrews from the point of view of reason and reality rather than name-calling. There's economic fear as well as cultural fear come into accepting the newcomer.
Can I ask a question? Why are you reluctant to use the word race? Why do you feel
racism? Look,
certainly in the French context, it seemed to me.
I was talking racist. About identity, so I was talking about what we are, not what we should be. If you start using words that are accusatory, you're not doing that. Yeah, I think the French riots, for example, were based on entirely different issues than the Cronulla riots, and they were fueled certainly by the by texting in both instances, but they lasted forever, and they were based they were made worse by the fact that there are true ghettos where people might spend generations, whereas in Australia the ghettos have tended, or the areas that the big immigrant group settles in, like Cabramatta for the Vietnamese in Sydney, their kids are moving out. Their kids want to live in the eastern suburbs or have a McMansion in the Blue Mountains or whatever. So it is a quality of opportunity to the extent that it exists in Australia, which has been our saviour, which has been what brings the immigrant and the immigrant's children, like those people I was talking about with the tomatoes, brings their children into the community. I don't think that's happening to those kids who rioted in France.
And we've got time for one more question. There's one right over there. Thank you.
You spoke a lot about the Greeks and Italians as previous waves of immigration, and I just wanted to know, do you think that the newer waves of immigration, like Africans and Middle Easterns, are really comparable in terms of their progression and their pathways in Australia?
An interesting... It's a very interesting question, but we have in Australia always seemed to get certainly from the Kenealys onwards, people from backward areas of countries. Us travelling in Turkey a few years ago and was talking about how worldly Istanbul is and other cities, and a man I was travelling with, a Turk, said, an Australian Turk, said, most of the Turks who immigrated to Australia come from peasant areas. And we took a lot of people from unfashionable areas of southern Europe, people who might have only been semi-literate, as most of our forebears were, people who were used to the hardest of soils and the most unjust terms in terms of land tenure. And I think the southern, they are not as far from, say, the southern Sudanese as you'd think, because I think we've always taken that kind of immigrant. And it's remarkable that it's worked, because it must be an extraordinary... There's going to be a great Australian novelist of Sudanese background who writes about straddling those two worlds, those worlds of militia, the violation of your mother and your sisters, the stealing of cattle, the burning of granaries, the enlistment of yourself into an army of children with the Kalashnikov. I think, though, that the gulf of education is in many ways not greatly different from that of some of the kids who immigrated post-war. You've got to realise that some of the displaced persons, as they were called, were in immigrant camps for a number of years, and they had some schooling, but some of them were sort of on the road, escaping from the Russians, moving and so on, for long periods and long traumatic periods as well. So I would guess, I mean, my first argument would be that it's not as big a gulf as it looks.
Thank you. I will have to conclude now, and it's my great honour to propose the vote of thanks. Tom, your address, as always, is a gesture towards the principle that public debate matters greatly in a civil society. It's your generosity of spirit, your ability to take the long view, the charitable view of Australia's polity, that gives us more melancholy and alienated citizens some hope. Your lecture tonight offered us a critique of the idea of national identity, its historical origins, and in our own colonial origins, in the constitutional debates of federation. You trace the long and indeed remarkable chronicle of Australia's successive waves of immigration in the 20th and 21st centuries. It's quite hard, I think, for some of us to accept this optimistic narrative when the tabloids and the airwaves that you described in your lecture seem to be filled with xenophobia and, I would say, race hatred. It's hard for first-generation Australians like myself to reconcile ourselves to that account of a benign Australia. But I have to admit, while I was listening to you, that I did have a moment of recollection back to the early 1960s at the Methodist Ladies' College in Elsternwick, and my sandwich, my lunchbox, was not mocked by my fellow citizens, when I had the pleasure of taking out the rye bread sandwich with the mustard and the schnitzel between the two rye bread sandwiches. They didn't mock me, and I didn't mock them, while they enjoyed their white bread and jam equivalents. So perhaps I too can see some progress in the narrative you're describing. Your lecture had all the hallmarks of your literary oeuvre: acute observation, stylistic panache, that usual wit, the enthusiastic use of the lessons of history, and the passion for social justice. Tom says that in the early 1970s, he discovered his inner hedonist, his party-going instincts, and the gifts of a natural storyteller. And I think from the 1970s on, that Tom has allowed his real nature to emerge, to be outrageous, to be a sort of lord of misrule. It is this irreverent anti-authoritarianism, this rebellious spirit, that we give thanks for. Over an extraordinary literary career and life as a public writer, Tom Keneally has opened himself up to this life in all its complexity. He's spoken, as the cliche would have it, truth to power. I think there's no greater contribution one can make. Please join me in thanking Tom Keneally.
Thank you. Thank you.